Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Kara Nodder about her contemporary novel, The Theory of Not Quite Everything. Kara was born in Johannesburg, and after graduating from the University of Cape Town, she joined Saatchi & Saatchi in London. And after graduating from the University of Cape Town, she joined Saatchi & Saatchi in London as a strategic planner. She lived in Japan, Hong Kong and Singapore before settling back in the UK with her husband and three children. In this episode, we discuss how fragments of inspiration came to her like pieces of a puzzle, why she struggled with the structure of her novel, and the importance of enjoying every win whilst keeping your expectations in check during publication. But before we hear that, here's Kara with an excerpt from The Theory of Not Quite Everything.
When Mimi stands at her door, she knows that the news is not good. Her body is familiar with the rules. Miss Brotherton, Naomi. She points inside to invite the police officers in. Her words won't come. It's a man and a woman. They brush non-existent fluff from their sleeves as they step across the threshold. They have the appearance of suicide bombers, packaged with padding and badges and belts and clips, a walkie-talkie each, many pockets. But it's terrible information, not a device, that they're about to detonate. They take up so much space in her hallway she has to inch around them to lead the way down the passage to the kitchen, where she can ask the question she thinks she knows the answer to. Is he dead? She pushes the post on the floor with her foot as if to tidy up. She sees his name on an envelope. She pulls her jumper down to straighten herself out and smudges imagined mascara residue from beneath her eyes, attending to some abstract decorum required for these moments, just before everything falls apart. It's impossible to prepare someone for the news of a loved one's death, but there are rules for such moments, and Mimi has seen them in action before. She'd tell you, don't procrastinate. The person will already know something is wrong from your demeanour, from the fact that you're calling or visiting at all. We send countless signals without knowing. Their body will be preparing for an emergency. Use plain and simple language. Start by saying the person has died. This leaves no room for doubt. Don't use euphemisms like passed on or they're in a better place now. Lost is particularly unhelpful. Just imagine. The truth is essential. You may need to repeat yourself. And don't make promises that you can't keep. Mimi's always been grateful that she was told by professionals, dead straight. She remembers last time, sitting on the corner of the coffee table, staring at a dry cleaning tag that her mother had left on the rug. Her brother Art was talking. The police officers had gone. We need to break this down into parts, Art had said, in a voice stunned into the rhythm of metronome. He looked around as if for a ruler with which to measure the parts of the shattered whole. And, he said, his voice faltering, plan for our future together. Yes, said Mimi. And just like that, he took her hand.
Hi, Cara. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really happy to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, The Theory of Not Quite Everything.
Hi, Chloe. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I'd love if you could start by introducing the novel to us and telling us what it's about.
So The Theory of Not Quite Everything is a novel about an adult brother and sister who live together in their childhood home. And they have got a very powerful bond. They bonded together by the early death of both of their parents. And we don't quite know what had happened to their parents. We find out a little bit more about that as the novel moves along. He's a maths genius, Art, and Mimi, his sister, is very dedicated to looking after his every need. And so her life has become somewhat limited. And to sum up, she's kind of fed up with it. She's not fed up with him. She's very devoted. She loves him dearly. Sometimes she resents him a bit, but she really does want a life of her own. And as she starts to reach out for independence, in some respects with the help of her brother, who she enlists, their very fragile, very precious equilibrium starts to falter. And she meets somebody and things get a little bit more rocky, and under the surface of the equilibrium is their past, which starts to rumble. And so we find out whether she finds the life she needs and wants and how their relationship does or doesn't survive.
Yeah, and we're going to be kind of careful to tiptoe around spoilers in this episode. And there are lots of kind of revelations and secrets involved, which we won't spoil, so there's no fear of that. But I wanted to ask you a little bit about the genesis of this novel, because I saw an interview with you where you mentioned that the kind of inspiration came to you in a sort of fragmentary way. And I think that is quite common for writers, that you don't just wake up suddenly with this amazing idea. It, you know, you hear something or you see something and bits and pieces come together a little bit like a puzzle. I know that's what it's like for me. Can you talk to us a little bit about this inspiration you had for this novel?
Yeah, I totally agree. I can't imagine it coming in one fell swoop. I heard Barbara Kingsolver talking the other day about Demon Copperhead and how she sat and banged her head on Dickens's desk and it all came to her in one fell swoop. Mine wasn't like that at all. And I can trace the inspiration, but only retrospectively. Now, I didn't know at the time that this was it. I'd written one book that was in a drawer and I was fiddling about writing random scenes, actually. And I'd just done a course at Oxford University about brain and behavior, sort of year-long adult learning course. And I'd learned about these psychological questionnaires that have got built-in lie detectors, which I thought was fascinating. And that must have seeded itself somewhere in my brain, because one afternoon I sat down and I wrote about this young woman, Mimi, who was filling in a psychological questionnaire. And her brother, Art, was standing behind her and reading over her shoulder. And he could see that she was lying. And more importantly, he understood why. And I didn't understand why, but I knew that he did, and that somehow it involved a sadness that they shared. And that was just an individual scene that I'd wrote and then left. The next day I wrote about a widow who had a chocolate melting in her pocket. I bumbled about with my life. And then a few weeks later, I was driving along and I was listening to Melvin Bragg on In Our Time, radio program I don't always understand, I must be honest. Do you ever listen to it?
No, it sounds far too intellectual for me.
Yeah, I'm really erudite. Anyway, this time they were talking about a maths problem, P versus NP, which apparently, if ever solved, would change the world and earn the mathematician $1 million. And I just remember thinking that's what Art is. He's a mathematician and this is his thing. He wants to solve this insoluble maths problem. And it wasn't about the $1 million or the prize, but it was about this idea that it was very powerful maths and that the change that it could, you know, bring to the world could wreak havoc and also change things in a very positive way. That started to shape my thinking. I read a little bit about P versus NP and what it meant. I didn't really understand it at first, but at least I had something. I knew that he would go down this rabbit warren hole and that he'd become obsessed. And then somehow I felt that that obsession would be the foil for Mimi's life, that it would somehow shape her life too. And I almost immediately felt her frustration of living on the outside of this thing that consumed the person she lived with. So that was the second thing. And then the third was also listening on a radio to Sigrid Rousing, who the author, and she's earned Grant, I think, for a long time. And she wrote a book in 2017 called Mayhem about her brother, who is a drug addict. And she wrote it from the point of view of what it's like to be the sibling, the other sibling of the very demanding drug addict, etc. And I thought that was a really interesting frame to look at the other sibling, the not sick or the not needy or the not drug addict or the not brilliant genius, as in the case of Mimi and Art. I quite like the idea of seeing things from Mimi's point of view. So my starting point was very much her story, her point of view, on the outside of this person who had the mathematical obsession. And once those pieces fell into place, I felt like I really had something to play with. Although at the center of it, I still wasn't sure what the sadness was that they shared. And that took time for me to discover and unearth.
Mm. So you almost felt like that Mimi and Art were almost following you around in your day-to-day life then?
They absolutely were. I really remember feeling like they'd occupied. I've written somewhere that they sort of occupied a territory in my brain. They sort of commandeered my thoughts. And I remember very clearly that moment, thinking, "That's it. That's Art's mathematical problem." And it felt like his, like he owned it. And then they didn't let me go. And it became the novel. So you're right, it was a fragmentary process, and it took quite a long time for me to work out that it was enough for a book.
I'm wondering then, you said you kind of started with the scene and then gradually started to think about both characters. When it came to building them up as characters and finding out what their personalities were like, did you kind of write more? Did you just kind of write scenes that came to you, or did you go about it in a more kind of methodical way of thinking, right, these are my characters and this is what's going to happen? Or did you just write?
So there's two parts to my answer to that. So first is that I'm not methodical in anything that I do. I wish I could show you my desk, if I could move my computer around. I mean, it's just a disaster zone. And I write a little bit like that. So I write what I feel like writing. So scenes that came to me, events that happened to the two of them, moments that they shared, little bits of their history, and slowly started to piece a story together. But I had no idea where the story was going. So that's the first answer, is that I'm not very methodical. And the other is that I started writing it on the Faber course, on the Faber novel writing course. And I wrote a first draft quite quick, you know, reasonably quickly, well, quickly for me. That sort of, I just wrote and wrote and wrote and got to the end eventually. But then realized that I had something, but that my characters were a little thin. And then I went back and sort of wrote pieces to myself. I remember thinking, okay, I need to know much more about their parents. And I started writing about their parents, scenes, just scenes, and learning for myself what they were about. So I didn't do the kind of question and answer thing that sometimes gets recommended. I thought, okay, I'm going to write the day the parents met, and off I went. And that bit made it into the book. But most of what I wrote did not. And I wrote a whole bit about Mimi's sexual history, you know, who her first boyfriends were and all that kind of thing. And then I had a lot of material and had to work out what went in and what didn't. But in terms of building the character, it was, you know, whatever the opposite word of methodical is, was that.
Well, while we're on the subject of being methodical, obviously Art is a maths genius. I was wondering how much research you have to do to embody his character. I mean, you said you looked at this equation and it baffled you to begin with, but I mean, how much did you have to learn in the end about maths?
So in terms of learning about his character, funnily enough, I didn't feel like I had to research too much. I mean, he's neurodivergent, and I get asked questions about that, but I don't feel like he's sort of representative of a particular point on the neurodivergent spectrum. I just think he's art, and I actually felt like I knew him very well from the beginning. In fact, the very first scene, that scene that I wrote, is a moment when Mimi pushes herself in the kitchen on a chair with wheels, a bit like the chair I'm in now, and she pushes herself towards the kettle to switch it on, and Art winces because he doesn't like wheels and noise and kettles. I'm learning him as I'm going along, and I knew that's who he was, this kind of highly sensitive person. But the math itself was difficult, and I think that's probably the thing I'm most proud of, is reading a whole book about P versus NP. And I can't claim to fully understand it. It's quite difficult to grasp, and it's a bit like sort of a mirage. I kept thinking I was getting closer, and then it would just seem further away. But I got to a point where at least I could explain it well enough, and I checked my understanding of it with mathematicians, and I seem to have got close enough. But it was very hard work. It was proper gymnastics for me to be able to use it in the book the way I wanted to use it, and for it to underpin the story as an idea as well as part of the story itself. I quite like this idea that there's a mathematical concept about not knowing what's going to happen until it actually does. So it was, yeah, that the maths was pretty hard work. It really was, but enjoyable, interesting.
I wanted to touch back on the structure of the novel, because I picked up on you mentioning that you kind of write scenes when you feel like it, and what kind of takes your fancy at the time, and the novel kind of came to you in that, you know, you'd write a scene about this or you'd write a scene about that. And the structure of the novel as it is that you have the everyday life playing out, but sometimes we find out things that have happened to Art in the future that we don't know what quite has happened. We also find that something has happened to their parents, and occasionally we'll get a flashback to their younger years or their childhood. And it's often kind of, I found that it was often related to something in the present, like an object that would remind them of something that happened. And I was wondering whether you were kind of conscious about the structure as you were writing it, or that happened kind of more organically because of it. It's the kind of the way you write. How did the structure come about?
With difficulty, actually. I had a fantastic editor helping me. I remember her saying, yeah, you've got a lovely book here, lovely idea, but a skeleton is what she said. But at the moment, it's a bag of bones in the back of a truck. And structure was the thing I struggled with the most, because the book required all these flashbacks. And once I really knew what I wanted to do with it, it had the flashbacks and had the history of the parents and all that stuff. And it wasn't very difficult to it wasn't very easy to handle. And in particular, I had these five missing days where the only person who knew what happened wasn't available to tell us the story. And I really didn't know how to handle that. So it took, I would say it was a combination of trial and error and learning along the way. It was a complicated puzzle. And at first I didn't really know what I was doing. I didn't understand some of the mistakes that I was making. And you know, it took several years to write this book. And by the time I got it finished, I knew a bit more than when I'd started. I don't know if I'd approach another book in such a messy way. It did give me, you know, big headache of how to sort out the structure. But on the other hand, I don't know if I could do it any differently. I don't think could write any differently. Do you write methodically?
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, marketers. Want a matchmaker to set you up with your perfect audience? Well, look no further. Get intimate right away with host-read sponsorships with Acast. Use Acast's self-serve ad platform to search and partner up with a podcaster or two from our network of more than 100,000 shows. Have them sing your praises in their own words. and get their listeners ready to be wooed into loyal customers. It's the ultimate loving endorsement. Book HostRed sponsorships with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
I do. I mean, it's a choice for me to kind of have a really structured plan, but it certainly wasn't like that for my first novel. Even though I went in with very good intentions, it changed massively. And then I found that I wasn't really following a plan. I knew where it was going to end. Yeah. So I felt like as long as I knew that, I could find my way there. Whereas now, writing my second book, I have a very detailed plan. I don't know whether it's 100% going to stay like stuck to the plan, because I think there's always room to, you know, move around. But I think sometimes a plan almost tricks your brain into reassurance. It makes you feel like, well, I don't need to worry now because I've got a plan. But I don't think writing is as straightforward as that, really.
No, I can't imagine. I don't know if I would find a plan reassuring or that would take away that sense of diving in and giving that, which is what gives me the energy to keep going.
My own
curiosity.
I think it's as well, there's differences between people who are able to write scenes out of sequence. Like you seem to be able to, like, I don't know, write chapter 17 before you write chapter 2, but I find it very difficult because I think, but I don't know what my character is going to feel like in chapter 17 because I haven't written chapter 2 yet. So I think it's
the answer is you don't know, you haven't yet, and so you end up rewriting so much.
What about the kind of the revelations towards the end and the discoveries that the reader makes? Were you very aware that those had to be left until the end, or were there times where you thought you would give away things nearer the beginning? Was that that part of the kind of editing process of deciding where these kind of revelations were going to end up?
That's a really good question, because it's, in a way, there are little revelations all the way along, but the revelations towards the end are almost in a group by themselves, and they were always at the end and remained there. I never thought about pulling them forwards other than to give a little bit of foreshadowing, which I would have put in here and there afterwards. But I wrote those. That was the only bit of the book that I actually wrote in sequence. I didn't finish it all, you know, wrapped up with Burr and then write the end. But I had written everything else towards that point in my first draft and wrote the end in a sort of, for me, it was a massive discovery, like, oh my God. And then when I did a very big edit, there was a whole another layer of, oh, right. And each time it was as we got to the end. And that sense of revelation that I had felt as a writer, I wanted the reader to feel.
Mm.
It felt absolutely right that is where the things either resolved themselves or didn't resolve themselves. Was that everything was working towards that, rather than that should be the beginning.
That's where you, as a person that doesn't necessarily plan, that's where the real special moment comes, where you make that discovery and then you have to go back and think, okay, well, how does this fit in with the rest of the story? Whereas if you're a hardcore planner, that discovery happens kind of early on. You don't get that kind of surprise moment. But then, like you say, it does mean going back and kind of adding little foreshadowing moments in. Anyone who hasn't read this book will be scratching their heads at this point, but anyone who has read it will know exactly what we mean. But it was fascinating that you hadn't always known that was the outcome and that you had to go back and kind of tweak things to make it work.
That is exactly how it happened. I remember I listened to an interview with Ian McEwan recently about, have you read his new book, Lessons?
I haven't either.
And it's about somebody who has suffered some form of abuse when they're young, and many years later, like 30, 40 years later, is going to face their abuser. And he describes how he imagines himself that person walking down a path towards the door where the abuser is standing on the other side of the door. And he said he literally embodies that person. His hand is the same hand that sort of is coming up to knock on the door. He has got no idea, as a writer, Ian McEwan, what is about to happen. And as I listened to him describe that, I thought, yes, that is the feeling that I really love, that feeling of I'm about to knock on the door of this and find out for myself. I really understood that.
So when you're faced with that blank page and the, well, maybe not in your case, I was going to say the terror of the blank page, that doesn't faze you? Is that kind of your happiest moment where you've got that empty space that you can fill with whatever kind of comes to mind?
No, I don't think the empty space is my happiest place. I'm sure I find it as intimidating as the next person. I think the happiest place is when you are in that free fall with your pen in your hand and you really don't know what's about to happen. It sounds so corny when you hear people say this. I'm so
aware. I know, I always used to think it was absolute rubbish when writers would say, and my characters do their own thing and they talk, and I'm like, no, that, and then it happens. And you suddenly find that one of your characters has said a bit of dialogue that you had not intended them to say, which completely changes the scene. And then you feel like, well, I can't go back now because it's out there, it's in the open. But yeah, I always used to think that was absolute rubbish, but I've experienced it now, so...
Funny, when I first started writing, I did a whole bunch of anonymous online courses. And the best advice they gave was just keep writing and write absolute crap. Don't worry about how bad it is, because you can always throw it away. We can always edit it later. So even if you're having a really bad day, just write and write, because maybe suddenly the path will veer and you'll be writing something good. So I'm never too afraid. I mean, I don't love the blank page, but I'm never too afraid of it because I don't fear writing rubbish. I feel like, oh, well, you know, if I write rubbish, I can fix it or throw it away or look at it.
Do you ever kind of have days where, not necessarily where you're writing rubbish, but you feel like you don't know what to write or you don't know what's coming next? What do you do in those situations where you, I guess it's the kind of writer's block phase. What how do you kind of deal with that when you have days like that?
I think I'll go for a walk. So the thing I find most difficult is when I, and I suppose this happened later on in the editing process, when you know that you've got to get a character from A to B. So, you know, this is sort of later on and it's kind of nearly there, but you realize, okay, I need art to do this and I need to feel that. So I need a scene that achieves X, Y, and Z. And for me, that's like, oh my God, you know, I can't just go and do my thing. I've got to go and think about it first and then actually achieve something. I find those scenes hard to write. And I would go for a walk and that often helps. I'll get an idea and think, okay, I can put them in this situation and then off I go. Yeah. Or in the shower. I mean, I know, again, right? Everyone says the shower. Or I'll just have a cup of tea. That often helps.
So I wanted to touch on a little bit more about your kind of journey to getting to this point, because I know you mentioned you did a Faber course and I know you've done other kind of writing courses, but I also saw that you had a mentoring at the Blue Pencil Agency. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that experience and why it was particularly beneficial to you as a writer, what transformed for you having this experience.
So I was very lucky. I landed in the hands of an editor there called Sarah Sare, who I'd asked the Blue Pencil Agency to do a read where you pay them to do a read with an editor's report of my first draft. And so she did that. And then she said, you know, she suggested that we meet for coffee, and we did, and we got on very, very well. And she said, look, there's something in here that I really like. I would be, you know, very happy to work with you. And I loved that idea. I loved the idea of not being alone all the time and having somebody to bounce my ideas off and also to learn from. You know, I knew that I had loads left to learn. I'd done the Faber course and I'd learned, you know, you'd done all those sort of basic modules and I'd done them over and over, online courses and Faber, but I didn't have much a good handle on structure. That's putting it mildly. And there were other things that I didn't have a good handle on. She felt that I had a sort of third person unreliable narrator that didn't, I hadn't really pulled off. And she helped me with that. And she taught me all sorts of little things along the way. Not least, she taught me to trust the reader a bit more. That was the biggest thing she taught me, to not over-explain, to step back and allow the reader to enjoy imagining and working things out for themselves.
How do you go about spotting that now you know the kind of secret that you're giving too much away?
I don't know if I can stop myself doing it until I've done it and then have to cut it out. I'm sure I still do it.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, do you have those same things where you think, okay, no, I didn't need to tell them that?
For me, in my experience, it's been easier to see it in other people's work and often see things that I do badly in other people's work and then say to them, oh, you've done this thing. And I know full well I do it myself, but it's easier to see it in other people's work than it is your own.
Yeah. So Sarah she explained that very well to me. So I started to be able to see it in my own work once I'd done it. I don't think I'm very good yet at stopping myself before I've done it. Mm. I think I go straight over the horse jump. But I guess one of the things that has helped me with that enormously was in the editing process rather than the writing process is that, do you know, have you read George Saunders's book, A Swim in the Pond in the Rain?
I have it, but I haven't read it. It's one of those many, many books that I have sitting on my shelves that I haven't got to yet.
Well, as a thank you for having me on your lovely podcast, I'm going to give you the gift of insisting that you read it, because it's the most helpful book I've ever read about writing. And it's got this, he talks about this, having this voice in your head, like a register, almost, I can never quite, like a, I want to say a pedometer, but it's not that. You're going to have to edit this rambling out now. But he talks about a process whereby you read your work and you imagine a scale and a needle moving on a scale of red to green. And it should be buzzing around in the green, feeling entertaining you. And as soon as it drops to sort of neutral or red, you just make a mark, because you're boring yourself. You're boring your reader. You've said too much. You've taken away the pleasure of the reader knowing for themselves. And he describes it really, really well in a very entertaining way. So that was helpful too.
Mm.
Backed up what Sarah had taught me.
I know a couple of writers that use the read aloud function on Word, and I used it recently. And actually, even though it reads it out in quite a robotic way, it still helps you identify those areas that are a little bit dull or repetitive or where it's just not quite right. And I found that incredibly helpful, which I'd never used before until really recently, because I heard about three people had mentioned to me about it and I thought, oh, I'll just give it a try.
What word reads back to you?
It's called Read Aloud. I think it's under the review section, I think it is, on Word, and it will read out. It doesn't like it if the document's too long. It does do a lot of stalling, but it reads it. I mean, it's slightly robotic, but the voices are quite good, so they do tend to read it in quite a fluid way. But it can be quite handy. It's kind of, it's that thing where hearing your work aloud is so much better to identify where there are issues than just reading in your head.
And sometimes you just really don't feel like reading it yourself.
Yeah. And as you know, having a book published, you've had to read it about 700 times.
Yeah, at least 700. definitely one too many.
So can you tell us how you found your agent and what the experience of looking for an agent was like for you?
Yeah, I can. So looking for an agent was tough. It took a long time. And I had a couple of false starts. And I used to, I think I wanted to become a writer to be a role model to my kids, to, you know, look what your mum did after bringing you up. And instead, I think I became a role model for picking myself up off the floor when I'd had another rejection. But I suppose the lesson for me was that it wasn't ready. I'd sent it out when it wasn't ready. And then when it was ready, I got nice interest, you know, quite quickly.
So has there been anything that you've experienced since you got your book deal, really, in the kind of publishing journey that you found particularly surprising or difficult or challenging that you've had to kind of deal with in some way, whether it's you know, just the emotional ups and downs of publishing. What has that been like for you?
I think, funny enough, the thing I've found the hardest is having to do any social media. I've not been on social media before. And if I'm honest, I don't like doing it. I find the idea of a sort of curated self very problematic. And the first 4 weeks or so of doing Instagram, I've found overwhelming and very unpleasant. I felt like I'd been sent to a party with 25 doors in a big room and people were pouring in through every door, and I'd been told I had to make friends with every single one of them immediately. And it freaked me out. But now, having a bit of passage of time, I can see the value in it. I can see how you can make some connections and how writers and people who are interested in books can get hold of one another. And I'm learning what my boundaries are for it. But I have genuinely found it very difficult to do. So that's probably been the hardest thing. And then I suppose you have to keep your expectations in check a little bit. I have to remind myself how happy I was when I got Charlotte, the agent, and then when she got the book deals, they were just so amazing. And so there are moments when people, especially from other people ask you, you know, if X is going to happen or if Y is going to happen, and you don't have those expectations yet, but it's hard not to take on other people's expectations. Mm. So I'm trying to remind myself at every step that I'm incredibly, incredibly lucky and very, very happy to be published at all, frankly. Which I do genuinely feel. I don't know if you feel that, but I do.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because not only are you getting other people's opinions, but the goalposts change all the time. So as soon as you've got an agent, you want the book deal, and as soon as you want get the book deal, you want something else. And yeah. there's always more to want. But I think perhaps if you were in the position where you'd achieved everything in with your first book, it would then make subsequent books difficult because you'd be forever comparing them to that first experience.
Yeah, I think that's true. I can see why second novels are tricky. Mm. Not least from a time point of view, because I mean, can someone tell me out there when on earth do you write your second novel? But yeah, that's exactly right. Moving goalposts, but I think it's very important to remember how happy you are and just stay, you know, stay in the moment. It's a pretty amazing ride.
So while we're on the topic, finally, Cara, can you tell us anything about what's next for you? What are you working on? Tell us a little hint about the next book.
So I'm working on it in my head right now, but that is actually a genuine answer. I do feel like there's something bubbling away and I'm excited about it. So if I wake up in the middle of the night, I am thinking about it. And I didn't do this on purpose, but I saw something that I thought was very, very interesting. And it puts me firmly back on the path of a book about siblings. So that's interesting that I found that alluring again. And then the other element is that there's a sort of STEM-y element as well. It's not quite the same, and none of the characters is the same, but there's an element of something that I'm going to have to learn quite a bit about and then find a way of making it interesting as a story. So, and that's about all I think I can say about it right now.
Well, you'll be diving back into your technical books again and finding someone to fact check it for you. Cara, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. It's been lovely to talk to you.
It's been lovely to be here. Thank you, Chloe. Thank you very much indeed.
That was Cara Nodder talking about her contemporary novel, The Theory of Not Quite Everything, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it would be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.